OEA. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is pleased to welcome students from the Trinity Middle School in Trinity, Texas, to see our court in session today. This morning we have three causes on which we will hear oral argument. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Phoenix Founders Incorporated and Others versus the Honorable John McClellan Marshall, an original mandamus proceeding. R.K. versus the Honorable Mario E. Ramirez, Judge, also an original mandamus proceeding. And Jerry P. Brook versus Bonnie L. Brook and others from Harris County. In each of these matters, we will allot 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Relators or petitioners may reserve a portion of that time to present rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will complete the arguments before the noon recess. The court is recording these arguments for our convenience, and if anyone desires to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Court is ready to hear from relators in Phoenix Founders versus the Honorable Marshall.
May it please the court, Mr. Luke Ashley will present argument for relators. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Luke Ashley with the Dallas law firm of Thompson & Knight. I'm pleased to be here this morning representing relators in this original mandamus proceeding. Relators are Phoenix Founders, Inc., the Phoenix Home Life Mutual Insurance Company, and a related entity collectively referred to in our briefings with this court as the Phoenix entities. The question that is presented in this case is a question of first impression in the state of Texas, and a very important question. It is what standards govern motions to disqualify law firms based upon allegations of conflict of interest as a result of the hiring or transfer of a non-lawyer employee. This is not only an important question in this case, in which Thompson & Knight has represented the Phoenix entities for more than 3 years in some very hotly contested litigation, but it is a situation that occurs with regularity, not only in large law firm practices, in major urban centers, but in small firm practices and in rural areas as well. The specific situation in which this context arose, the basic facts underlying this mandamus petition are not in serious dispute. Denise Hargrove was a real estate legal assistant at Thompson & Knight for several years. She terminated her employment with Thompson & Knight in June of 1993, went to work for 3 weeks at the law firm of David & Goodman, who was representing the Beneckes, the opposing parties to Phoenix in the underlying litigation. After 3 weeks, disillusioned with her employment situation at David & Goodman, she announced that she was terminating her employment there on a Friday afternoon and returning to work at Thompson Knight in the real estate section the following Monday. There is no claim, no evidence that Ms. Hargrove had any work responsibility for the Phoenix matter during the time that she originally worked at Thompson Knight, no claim that she had any responsibility for that matter during the short period of time after her return to Thompson & Knight.
If either of those circumstances had occurred, would you be disqualified?
Well, I don't believe we would be disqualified had she worked on the matter before. Under the circumstances of this case, it would be a much closer question had she done what she did at David & Goodman with respect to the underlying litigation and then come back to Thompson & Knight and had some responsibility at that time for the Phoenix matter. But obviously that is not the situation here. There's also not much dispute over what she did when she was at David & Goodman. She was not directly assigned to work on and had no substantive responsibility for the Phoenix Benegi litigation. At the request of one of the lawyers at David & Goodman, she did essentially a clerical task. She spent approximately 6/10 of an hour attempting to locate a pleading or motion, or more specifically, a date on a pleading or motion, and had possibly had one conversation with the supervising attorney in which he directed her to perform that task.
Based on the standard employed by Judge Marshall in ordering the disqualification, could you have urged the disqualification of the Goodman Law Firm based on this employee's leaving Thompson Knight and going to work there?
Well, yeah, again, I think under the standard that Judge Marshall applied in this case, it may well be that the Phoenix entities would have the right to seek the disqualification of David & Goodman. What Judge Marshall did in this case was apply the most extreme form of the doctrine of automatic vicarious disqualification. Judge Marshall did not find that Ms. Hargrove had actually received or become privy to any confidential information concerning the Phoenix Benegi litigation during the time she was employed at David & Goodman. In fact, he specifically found that she did not. On page 95 of the record, when he states his findings after the original evidentiary hearing in September 17, he stated the court finds no evidence that confidential client information other than what would be supplied by the presumption of petroleum wholesale as a guiding case in this matter was provided to Ms. Hargrove. What Judge Marshall then did was rely upon an irrebuttable presumption that he felt was required under the petroleum wholesale case, a case that was decided by the Dallas Court of Appeals involving lawyers. And he applied an irrebuttable presumption not only that Ms. Hargrove had obtained confidential information, but an irrebuttable presumption that in addition she had shared that confidential information with lawyers at Thompson & Knight, the lawyers responsible for the representation, when she returned. And as a result, not only Ms. Hargrove was precluded from working on the Phoenix Benegi litigation, but the entire firm was disqualified as well. It is our position that Judge Marshall therefore applied an improper legal standard. And as we've outlined in our filings with this court, we submit that the proper legal standard is that articulated by the California Court of Appeals that thoroughly considered a similar situation in connection with some asbestos litigation. In that, under that standard, there would be a rebuttable presumption that an employee or non-lawyer employee who had actually worked on a matter at one firm acquired confidential information. In addition, upon transfer, there would be a rebuttable presumption that those confidences were shared with the lawyers responsible for the litigation at the transferring or the receiving firm. In this case, there is no evidence, indeed there is no claim, that Ms. Hargrove communicated any confidences to any of the personnel at Thompson Knight responsible for the Phoenix Benegi litigation upon her return. Judge Marshall's ruling depends exclusively upon an irrebuttable presumption that occurred. In fact, he specifically rejected an offer of proof that to make additional showings beyond that is already in the record that Ms. Hargrove did not have any opportunity and did not, in fact, communicate anything to the personnel responsible for this litigation when she returned to Thompson & Knight. In this case, there really is no showing that Ms. Hargrove had any confidences herself, so that the presumption that she had as a result of having any contact with the file of David and Goodman was in fact rebutted by the evidence as well. Judge Marshall, in addition, felt that that presumption was irrebuttable, and as his finding that I just quoted before indicates, he actually specifically found she didn't have any confidential information, but that the presumption was irrebuttable that she had, and then he applied the presumption that said she had shared that. As he indicated,
if Judge Marshall's conclusion is so baseless, then how come you terminate the paralegal on the basis of a claim?
I think the record reflects, Your Honor, that the termination actually was for matters beyond the Phoenix Benedict litigation. Certainly, there is evidence that Ms. Hargrove herself didn't advise us at the time that she returned that she had had any connection with this file.
But she hadn't worked on it any at Thompson and Knight. She didn't work on it any at Thompson and Knight, and she did 6/10 of an hour of it there. And so that's the kind of thing that you think an employee should know and
should be aware of
your entire litigation.
In this case, when she told Mr. Goodman that she was leaving, he had a conversation with her where he expressed concern about this. Indicated to her that he felt there was a problem. She did not tell us about that. In addition, the record reflects that she had taken some forms, some real estate forms, at the request of the attorney that she followed over to David and Goodman, and that unrelated to the Phoenix Benneke litigation. And so the termination occurred as a result of her lack of judgment, not only in not telling not advising us of the situation that Mr. Goodman had expressed concern about, but also, and in fact primarily because of her actions in taking the forms from the firm and taking those over to David Goodman. The rule that Judge Marshall imposed, an irrebuttable presumption, both that she had acquired confidences and an irrebuttable presumption that she had shared confidences, simply does not fit and is much too broad to properly address the policy concerns that are involved in these situations. As the California court and a number of other courts have stated in considering these matters, the disqualification of a litigants' counsel of choice implicates serious concerns. The Fifth Circuit has even held that in a civil case, the right to choose counsel, an individual litigant's right to choose counsel, is in fact a constitutional right. In addition, there are concerns of mobility and allowing non-lawyer employees the flexibility to change employment.
Judge Marshall irrebuttably presumed that the information was shared when she returned to Thompson Knight. What is the significance of his finding that there were no procedures to keep information from being shared?
Well, I think the significance of the finding is, I don't believe there is any material significance to that finding under his standard. He found that she was irrebuttably presumed to have shared those, and so it wouldn't have mattered. I think his point was that had we been able to find out about this situation before, we wouldn't have hired her at all. Under his standard, we would have known that we would have had to disqualify ourselves if we had hired her. Under the correct standard, the existence of screening procedures, what actually happened, is significant in determining whether the presumption that any confidences that the non-lawyer employee had have been shared. But it is not, as the cases we've cited, the Capco case, the California complex asbestos case, and I believe it's the Panduit case from the D.C. Circuit, all indicate that whether screening was employed or whether a pre-employment interview was sufficient to identify the situation is only one factor, and it is not determinative of whether the presumption has been rebutted. Screening is not the only way to rebut a presumption that the competences have been shared. I think it's clear that the only way that Judge Marshall's orders can be upheld on this record is if the court is going to employ both irrebuttable presumptions and fashion a rule that it seems to me would be extremely harsh, unfair to litigants, unfair to the non-lawyer employees who transfer from law firms every day, and in fact would cause an increase in the type of strategical or tactical motions to disqualify that I think it's clear we have here. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott Scherr, with an argument for respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Scherr. I'm with the law firm of Woolley Gulch Scherr. I'm here on behalf of the respondents and as special counsel, see Ron and Jane Beneke, the parties in interest. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the court for hearing this matter. It certainly represents not only a highlight of my legal career to be before you all, but also gives us all an opportunity to square away some issues which are important to all of us that practice in the state of Texas. And I think that opportunity is here to not only go on theory, but to go on the actual facts of this case and to determine how this court can rule upon this motion, upon this issue, to foster and encourage the use of paralegals and the efficient and economical use of legal services in the state of Texas without discouraging clients from doing that. And the only way to do that, and the only way to accomplish that, in our opinion, is to uphold Judge Marshall's decision. Whether this court upholds Judge Marshall's decision on the strict application of petroleum wholesale, or whether it upholds Judge Marshall's decision on the standards that the relator propounds, which is rebuttable presumptions. The record still says that Judge Marshall's decision has to be upheld. But why should petroleum wholesale be applied to paralegals, and why should it be applied in this case? Simply because courts have recognized, including this court, that there's an increasing usage of paralegals for the very same thing that lawyers are used for, of course, under the supervision of a lawyer.
This wouldn't apply to the secretary?
Your Honor, I think that it might in certain instances apply to a secretary. And those instances are instances such as the CAFCO case, where there was a secretary. And in CAFCO, what the court said, the federal district court, I believe it was out of Illinois, ruled on that very decision. They looked at the secretary and they said, you've done paralegal duty. And normally, we won't apply attorney standards to a secretary. We're going to apply different standards. But they specifically said in CAFCO, a case cited by relators in this court, they specifically said in CAFCO, because you are doing lawyer functions and because you have access to competences, we're going to apply the same standard to you as we apply to lawyers. Now, granted, that was a different standard than this court or this state has been applying for lawyers. It wasn't an irrebuttable presumption. It was a rebuttable presumption. But CAFCO expressly held that we are going to apply the same standard to you.
If very few lawyers practice in firms of more than three or four people with one or two paralegals, then an absolute petroleum wholesale rule might make a lot of sense in terms of simplicity and administration of justice. But the town that this case arises out of has numerous law firms of over 100 people. They're combining and splitting apart sort of like amoebas, and the absolute application of this rule, it seems to me, makes it virtually impossible for lawyers or paralegals with any confidence to go change jobs,
either by choice
or because they have to.
Your Honor, I think that there's two issues to be weighed and considerations to be weighed in that regard. Petroleum wholesale is not to be applied and was never intended to be applied in any case where a firm once represented somebody. We have this court the most egregious situation. It's a pending litigation between, it's the same case pending litigation. It's not even substantially related. It is an actual case going on. That's one distinction between most of the other areas where that would occur. The second thing is, what is going to foster the use of paralegal? Is it going to be that they're not mobile in the one limited instance when a pending litigation and there's a transfer, or is it going to occur because people don't have confidence that if I use this paralegal and the other side then hires them, my confidences are at risk? I would suggest to the court that the latter is a greater concern to this court and to this state and to the public for the use of paralegals. It will foster the use of paralegals. It will foster economic and efficient use of our legal resources to use those paralegals. My clients, I'm in a small law firm, I depend on paralegals. My clients would be reluctant to use those paralegals if they knew that they could go to opposing counsel and not have that opposing counsel be disqualified with all the confidences they've bestowed upon them. So there are competing interests there. I don't believe it would restrict mobility. I believe it would foster the use of paralegals and increase...
Aren't there ongoing cases in Dallas County where six or eight law firms are involved and the litigation may go on 4 or 5 years?
There are those litigations, Your Honor. And if the court is not to...
There's quite a few of them.
There are quite a few.
The absolute application of petroleum wholesale more or less lock everybody in place. And if there's an economic downturn, they're just out of luck.
I think the court is focused on the fact that there are a lot of law firms in Dallas, Texas that have many lawyers that provide those venues for the people to transfer to. There are also many, many law firms that are seeking paralegals. To the extent that one paralegal may not be able to go to one law firm, is that too high a price to pay to ensure that litigants' confidences are not disclosed to the opposing counsel? In addition, to the extent this court has at least adopted or touched upon the petroleum wholesale standards, as has the Fifth Circuit, of irrebuttable presumptions for lawyers, is there any justification for not applying that same standard to paralegals who are 15-year paralegals versus a one-year associate? Even if this court does not adopt the petroleum wholesale standards, however, if the court determines that rebuttable presumption should apply to paralegals, this case clearly provides that Judge Marshall's decision should still be affirmed. And the reason for that is there has been no evidence to rebut any of those presumptions.
What evidence is there that she obtained confidential information?
In the complex asbestos case, which the later cites as support for the standard that should be adopted, they specifically stated that you don't have to go into specifics and say she's got a confidence that they said we were going to lose this litigation or we have a weak case. They said you have to give instances where of specific acts that would subject them to those confidences.
She testified she had none, although she's obviously a little vague on what some would be. Why doesn't that reflect?
She testified on direct cross-examination by the labor that she had no confidential information. She did testify, however, also that she reviewed files, that she reviewed pleadings, that she didn't know whether or not they were filed or not. They could have been drafted. And in fact, a counterclaim has been filed subsequent to all of this arising, which was in draft form at that time. She testified that she had conversations, there was testimony she had conversations with Mark Goodman. She testified she spoke to Sally Bivey of Gardeer and Wynn, who is co-counsel on the case, to certainly where certain confidential information and privileges would apply.
None of those attorneys testified that she had confidential information.
Well, and Your Honor, that is what...
Is that true?
That is, the attorneys testified that they could not tell whether she did. Mr. Goodman testified that he discussed the case with her.
Was the conversation with Goodman the same one that opposing counsel referred to when he expressed concern about potential conflict, or were there other conversations?
No, Mr. Goodman said that he had had a conversation prior to the time that she performed the work on the case to give her some background on the case and guidance in what she was looking for. The problem...
Well, if Attorney Goodman told her, we're probably going to lose this case, for God's sake, don't tell anybody, then at this hearing, he certainly would have testified she had confidential information.
Well,
is that, so the fact that he didn't, doesn't that indicate that he doesn't think he conveyed any to her?
I think that the testimony was clear in its ambiguity that Mr. Goodman was unsure of exactly what his conversation was. He did testify, he talked freely about his cases. I think he was clear. And isn't this the reason, Your Honor, why we have to have these presumptions? Because we can't expect lawyers to be putting paralegals under a microscope and examining every single act and event that they are performing. To do so would be double billing. We would not be getting any beneficial use out of our paralegals if we sat there and watched every single act they did. We have.
But if the presumptions are truly rebuttable, then it looks to me as if the lawyer with whom the paralegal had contact testifying that he didn't know of any information, or not testifying that he did know, rebuts that presumption. Why doesn't that rebut it?
Because I don't believe that by Mr. Goodman saying, I don't know whether she had confidential information or not, that rebuts a presumption. I think you need affirmative evidence to rebut a presumption that she did not have it. The only evidence before this court that does anything with that presumption is the following. Rather than constructing a Chinese wall or any screening procedure, once they found out that there was an issue of a conflict of interest, what did Thompson and Knight do? The testimony is clear that Thompson and Knight called Ms. Hargrove into Ms. Littman's office, the lead counsel on the litigation, and Ms. Littman didn't say, don't talk to anybody about this case, don't get involved in this case. She said, tell me everything you know about this case. That's the uncontroverted evidence in the record. She said to her, tell me everything you know. And what resulted from that meeting after she said, tell me everything you know? Three things. Ms. Littman, again, undisputed, called Mr. Goodman and said, I have confidential information about your firm that Ms. Hargrove knows. And if you proceed with this disqualification hearing, these confidential information will be disclosed and it's going to be embarrassing to your firm. Undisputed in the record. What's the second thing that happened as a result of this conversation? Thompson and Knight terminated. They try to say she resigned. They terminated Ms. Harper for conflict of interest. That's the undisputed evidence in the record. They themselves terminated an employee for a conflict of interest as a result of that conversation. Mr. Ashley states to this court that there's other evidence in the record that says it from some form. That was in a deposition transcript that they attached to their reply that was never placed in the record in the court below and never placed in the record in this court, and we object to that evidence. It was never, ever presented to the trial court. The third thing they did is, despite the fact that they threatened Mr. Goodman with confidential information, despite the fact that they terminated Ms. Hargrove for a conflict of interest, they refused to terminate themselves. They apply a double standard to their own employment with their client versus Ms. Hargrove's employment with them. So there was no, if anything, even without a presumption, the evidence conclusively and irrebuttably establishes that the result of that conversation was that she did have confidential information. Why would Thompson and Knight, why would they terminate somebody for a conflict of interest if they didn't have confidential information? It's incredulous to me that notwithstanding Rule 5.03 of the disciplinary rules, that they never instituted a screening procedure in the first place. It's even more incredulous to me that once they find out about a conflict, rather than isolate the person, they ask them to tell them everything they know. Now, Ron and Jane Beneke are sitting here in this litigation, going against in a hotly contested litigation, and being forced to litigate this case with a law firm that has terminated an employee based upon a conflict of interest, a recognition that she's got confidential information about their case. And is it fair to Ron and Jane Beneke, and is it fair to the public where these records are open, to see that this situation exists? We suggest not.
Would your position be the same if Hargrove had not had anything to do with this litigation at the Davis law firm?
Davis and Goodman?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Petroleum Wholesale, and in response to a question that I believe Your Honor had asked Mr. Ashley, whether Goodman is actually disqualified to his firm, Petroleum Wholesale has two imputed knowledge levels. It's the single imputed knowledge and then the double imputed knowledge. Had Ms. Hargrove never touched the case at David and Goodman, if she had imputed knowledge under Petroleum Wholesale, when she went over to back to Thompson & Knight, Thompson & Knight would not have been disqualified because that would be a double imputation. Ms. Hargrove would not have been able to work on the case, but Thompson & Knight could work on the case. The screening mechanisms at a minimum, what we're faced with here today is the screening mechanisms at a minimum would create and would avoid these situations that we have before this court, because they would either allow Thompson & Knight to make the reasoned decision that they made afterwards, which is that I'm not going to rehire you, I'm not going to create the conflict, or they would allow them, if this court so adopts for paralegals, a Chinese wall standard. However, once that Chinese wall is not built, once the cat is out of the hat, you can't resurrect that wall. At Texas Ethics Opinion number 472, which initially was cited and continues to be cited by relators, is on point on this. In its discussion of the pre-screening under 5.03, the committee expressly dealt with the fact that 5.03 is meant to deal with disqualification under the appearance of impropriety standard that formerly existed. And it expressly deals with 5.03 as a disqualification issue. It says, we don't have an appearance of impropriety anymore. However, you have a responsibility to make sure that these events don't occur. And that's 5.03. Thompson & Knight readily admits, even here today, that they didn't know that Ms. Hargrove worked on the case of David Goodman. That's because they didn't have those procedures in place. It was their responsibility to know that.
If they'd employed a screening procedure, would you lose?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the screening procedure necessarily would be fatal to my client's position or Judge Marshall's decision. And the reason is as follows. This is the same case, direct work situation. I think screening procedures have been recognized generally as being an effective way to deal with public servants going into the private sector. And it's an appreciation and for the work they've done for us and to allow them to get employment elsewhere. I think the same standard needs to be applied with respect to paralegals as lawyers in this regard. Even if it's not, I don't know how the screening procedures were never employed in this. If the court wants to determine that screening would be an appropriate place, paralegal, going basis, I think that would disprove that the Petroleum Wholesale runs counter to it. However, I don't think it changes the result in this case.
How do screening procedures are performed by the firm that you are seeking to disqualify and resolve the appearance of impropriety concern that you have?
Well, I think the problem is that there's a recognition, and I'll get to the second point that I'm going with on this in a second, but there's a recognition that people chat, people go to lunch, people talk about things. If there are no formal procedures set up, that tendency is even more apt to occur. The second issue, and especially with paralegals, and I think everybody recognizes, they're not under the same duties as lawyers are with respect to those confidences in the abstract. It's the lawyer's responsibility to ensure that those confidences are kept by that paralegal. That screening process assures that. And how does that relate in this case? Ms. Hargrove admitted on the stand she had no idea what confidential information was. Anything she obtained at David Goodman, she thought was fine to go ahead and chat about with anybody at Thompson & Knight. Had there been a screening procedure in place, Thompson & Knight, I'm sure, would have said, anything you know about that case, I don't care if you think it's confidential or not, anything you know about that case, do not discuss with anyone in this firm. We're going to lock the files up. You're not going to have access to them. The fact of the matter is, this case, as I said, the facts of this case are unique in that they give us a reason, a tangible reason to apply principles and theories that have been applied before. Because the reason you need to screen is because paralegals may not know what confidential information is. And Ms. Hargrove demonstrated that. The reason you need these presumptions is because, as in this case, is a law firm who refuses to refuses to disqualify themselves, are they going to come in and say, yes, I have confidential information about the other side? Obviously not. Thompson and Knight acknowledged they had confidential information in their internal papers when they terminated Ms. Hargrove for that conflict. But they're refusing to state that here. That is why the presumptions are absolutely necessary. Under any of those presumptions, whether it be rebuttable or not, Judge Marshall should be sustained. We posit to the court that the irrebuttable presumption, at a minimum in a pending litigation matter, needs to be applied. There is just no distinction between certain competences that are bestowed upon an attorney and a paralegal. And the privilege extends to paralegal under the civil rules of evidence. And the court has acknowledged that and implied that, that those privileges extend.
Do you see any difference between the position you argue and if Davis and Goodman had required Ms. Hargrove to sign a covenant not to compete that would prevent her from performing paralegal services in Dallas County for the next 5 years?
I see a real distinction. I don't see, in the covenant not to compete, it's without regard to whether there's a threat that the information that she's obtained during her employment will be used against the clients. It's not, the covenant not to compete is to protect David and Goodman in the information and training that they've given her to become a paralegal. We're not looking at that issue here. This issue is strictly how we're protecting the general public.
I'm saying the focus is different, but in effect, the rule you're arguing would prohibit any sort of intra-firm movement by paralegals, by secretaries, anyone who comes in contact with confidential information.
I am not necessarily advocating it for anyone but paralegals and attorneys and before this court. I think there is a distinction. I also am not advocating it for anything but for cases in which that paralegal had actually worked the file. It's a small price to pay to preserve the integrity of the judicial system, and it's a small price to pay to encourage the use and employment of paralegals. Because without that protection, nobody's going to use paralegals. I know that without that protection of some presumption, I'm going to have to tell my client, well, you can use my paralegal, but I'm going to have to watch everything she does so I can conclusively prove she's got confidential information if she goes to the other side. No one's going to use them either way. So I think we're encouraging the use of paralegals by adopting this standard and not discouraging.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Several points in rebuttal. First of all, I don't think that the rule that the court would promulgate in this case, while it does, this particular situation involves a legal assistance, that it would be limited to legal assistance. There is a wide variety, a wide range in the types of tasks and the degree of responsibility that legal assistants have. Some do tasks that are very similar to the things that lawyers do. Others are essentially clerks with nothing more than clerical responsibility in a particular case. Other non-lawyer employees have a similar range in their responsibilities. Investigators, secretaries often function very much like legal assistants. In fact, some secretaries probably have considerably more responsibility for a particular case than a legal assistant may in another situation. An information system specialist who designs a computer program to manage documents in a particular case certainly can be privy to confidential information about that particular case. There are a number of other situations where that would occur. A secretary, even a temporary secretary, who types a particularly sensitive pleading. So I don't think that the rule that the court would promulgate in this case can be limited to legal assistance, or that there's some way to carve out a rule that would be applicable to legal assistance, but not to other non-lawyer employees, at least not a rule that would make any practical sense. Second, This is not just an application of the principles enunciated by the Dallas Court of Appeals in petroleum wholesale. The rule that the real parties in interest are arguing for would be a significant and very drastic extension of that rule. Justice Hecht asked me a question about whether David and Goodman would be disqualified or could be disqualified in these circumstances. If the presumption of shared confidences is going to be irrebuttable, as I believe I understood opposing counsel indicate he felt it should be, there was an irrebuttable presumption that Ms. Hargrove had shared confidences concerning the Phoenix Beneke litigation while she was originally at Thompson Knight. And the David and Goodman firm, therefore, could not hire her without being itself vulnerable to disqualification, and certainly could not have allowed her, when she was hired over there, to do anything with respect to this particular file. There's also a question about the evidence. Yes.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that when she came back, rather than isolate her from any contact, she was quizzed as to what she knew about the case?
No, and I was just coming to that. That is simply incorrect. There was a, when the disqualification controversy arose, that is when Mr. Scherr wrote the letter and stated that he felt that Thompson Knight needed to withdraw, there was a conversation between Ms. Lippman and Ms. Hargrove. She was specifically asked about that at the hearing, and what she said was, question, when I met with you on Monday the 23rd, did I advise you that if you had any substantive knowledge about the Beneke's or the Phoenix case, that I did not want to know that? Answer, yes. Did I ask you to simply tell me physically what type of work you had done in terms of any activity with regard to the file? Answer, yes. And again, Judge Marshall, in his findings that I quoted earlier, specifically found that Ms. Hargrove did not have any confidential information as a result of her employment in David and Goodman. He further did not make any finding that she had in fact shared any information about the case, any substantive information or confidential information about the case with anyone at Thompson and Knight. With respect to the screening procedures, it seems to me again, the case should not turn on the existence or non-existence of screening procedures when you're talking about whether to disqualify the law firm from its representation. The screening procedures do not provide any guarantee that this type of problem will be discovered. In fact, the indication is that Ms. Hargrove, she didn't tell us about this when she came, even though Mr. Goodman had expressed to her his concern. You could well have a situation where the employee would deny that they had had any contact with the file at the other law firm. So even if you have a screening procedure, it's no guarantee that the situation would actually be discovered. The question on a motion for disqualification then should be, was there in fact any violation of the shared confidences that would justify disqualification under those particular circumstances?
Any questions? Thank you, Kevin. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.